The following live presentation by Rabbi Benny Friedman is brought to you by Israelite, inspiring a renaissance in Jewish living. To learn more about Israelite, please visit our website at www.israelite.org. Additional contact information is available at the end of this presentation. Thank you for learning with Israelite and enjoy the experience.
This is an interesting portion, interesting parsha this week, the portion of Mishpatim. And rather than pick a particular mitzvah, a particular detail, I thought maybe it'd be worth sort of at least discussing a much broader topic. Okay? You know, I remember when I was in the army, there were certain things that I really felt I was getting a lot out of, even though they were difficult. And there were certain things that I really couldn't stand. And one of the things that you learned to hate in the army was something that was called mizdar. Okay, a mizdar, or an inspection, was something that you did every morning, and you did at the end of every day in the kitchen, and you did before every patrol. And sometimes they made a lot of sense. You know, before you go on a mission or a patrol, you check everybody's gear, and you check their ammo and their readiness, and that they have their dog tags and all that sort of thing. And that makes sense. Everybody understands that. But morning inspection, which was about making sure that the blankets were neat and made, and that the floor was washed, and that you had all your gear, and that your boots were polished and all this sort of thing. So if you were in a combat unit, you learned to hate these things. But as much as I hated this as a soldier, that was nothing compared to how much I hated it as an officer. Because when you became an officer and you had to do these inspections sometimes, then you actually had to be the mamzer. You had to be the guy who would, you know, post somebody up for the slightest infraction or make them stay an hour on Friday and miss the bus for nonsense, for not polishing the boots, for, you know, et cetera. And it took me years to understand this, you know, because our mindset, our Western mindset, lives in the broad range of ideas. We love the general topic. No, you won't find anybody who doesn't say, we want peace. Right? You just, even go to Iran and ask Ahmadinejad, and even he'll tell you, we want peace. Right? Most people want peace. But when you get down to the details, when you get down to the nitty-gritty of peace, you know, like having to wait on longer lines at the bus stop because Jews and Arabs are getting on the bus together, or having less room at the lunch counter in the South because now African Americans are also allowed in the restaurant. So people have a much harder time with the details, right? Everybody talks about safety, and everybody sighs when they hear about a terrible car accident. But when you're in a car, just yesterday I came home from the airport, and the cab driver was bemoaning the fact that he got caught on the sort of highway that goes into Ben Gurion Airport, which is a very, very wide road, lots of lanes, and looks like a 55 mile an hour speed limit. It looks like a 100 kilometer an hour speed limit. In fact, it's even wider than the highway. And it's usually very empty. Right? But it turns out that the speed limit there is 50 kilometers an hour, which is about 25 miles an hour. No one drives on this road 25 miles an hour. So he was really upset that some cop stopped him and ticketed him for 40 kilometers over the speed limit, which in Israel is an automatic loss of license unless he can plead it out in court for 3 months, which for a cab driver is a big deal. And we like the broad ideas. Nobody says road safety isn't important, but when you get down to the details, it becomes very difficult, right? All of which leads us to a very interesting question, okay? There are very few parshiot, very few portions that are more detail-oriented than this week's portion. In fact, the name of this week's portion, Mishpatim, is basically, you know, laws, statutes. And statutes are all about details, right? In fact, it's interesting that one of the challenges of law very often is to be able to keep the broader picture, to understand where the specific law or the detail of the law fits within the larger picture. And that may well be one of the reasons why our system of law is called mishpat. A mishpat also means a sentence, right? And very often, if you don't know how to fit a word into a sentence, then the whole sentence makes no sense. But this week's portion is all about laws. right? It's mostly about the laws that appertain to business dealings and ethics. What do you do when your ox gores your fellow, your neighbor or your neighbor's ox? What happens if someone falls into your pit? How do you make sure your weights are even and honest, right? Laws of litigation, right? In fact, there are six tractates, or rather six siddarim, six orders, maybe you call it in English, in the Mishnah, in the oral tradition, right? There's six of them. The first is Zra'im, which literally means seeds, which except for the first tractate of Brachot deals with the agricultural laws, right? The second is called Moed, which means time, and they deal with Shabbat and the festivals, right? The laws of Passover, Pesach, the laws of Rosh Hashanah, the laws of Shabbat, the laws of Sukkot and the Sukkah, the tabernacles and booths, right? And then you have Nashim, the laws literally means women, but those are the laws of marriage and of divorce and of the relationships between men and women, right? And then you have, and also of oaths, which have much to do with relations between men and women. And then you have Nizikin, right? Nizikin are the laws of damages and torts, right? By the way, just to finish it off, the other two, right, are kachim or the laws of holiness, which are all the laws that deal with the temple and the sacrifices, etc. And the last one is tarot, which deals all with, you know, ritual purity and the laws of mikveh and whatnot, right? Most of the laws of nizikin, of damages, are learned from this week's parsha. So this is a very detail-oriented parsha, which leaves us basically, or causes us to at least consider, two different questions. The first question is, you know, I would have thought, I mean, if there was ever a huge anticlimax in the Torah, it's this week, right? Last week we read how the Jewish people stood before Mount Sinai, right? They came practically face to face with God. They took their relationship with God to a whole new level, right? And they received the Torah. And Mount Sinai is considered to be the marriage of the Jewish people, right? And Moshe walking down with the tablets, right? So that's like considered allegorically the ketubah, the marriage document of the Jewish people, right? And I would have assumed, I mean, this is a very lofty moment. And so I would have assumed that this week would continue along that vein. I mean, the beginning of the book of Shemot is so powerful. The 10 plagues and the exodus from Egypt and then the splitting of the sea and then Mount Sinai, right? And this week, when you review this week's parsha, it's all mundane. It's all about court procedures and damages. Is that all that there is to learn after the inspiring events of Mount Sinai, of receiving the Torah? Is this the significance of receiving the Torah that now we're going to get to nitty gritty? It's not a simple question. Right? Imagine that you have the most incredible wedding, and you're madly in love, and you finish the wedding, and it's so beautiful, and the next day, your wife sits you down and says, okay, let's talk about how we're organizing the chores when we get home. I mean, they're not even in Israel yet. Who wants to start with that? Enjoy the Bahamas. Go to Yerushalayim on your honeymoon. You have to talk about who takes out the garbage. Right? About what happens if, listen, this is my car, this is your car, how are we going to share the car? How are we going to carpool one day when we have children? I mean, it's such an anticlimax. And then, of course, there's another question, which as well deals with the broad topic, right? Which is very interesting that Rav Kook actually points out in a couple of places, especially in Orot HaTshuvah. Think about the fact that this book, right, there are five books in the Torah. And we're now in the second book. The first book is about beginnings, right? It's the beginnings of the world and the beginnings of mankind and the beginnings of what Jews have to offer the world, of a family of Jews. This book, the second book, Shemot or Exodus, right? This is about the birth of the Jewish people. This is how the Jews are born as a nation. And everything in this book is all about the birth of the Jewish people, right? Their experience in an exodus from Egypt, they're receiving the Torah, and even the subsequent parshiot that we're going to begin getting into next week, which are the creation of a tabernacle, a mishkan, right, which is the predecessor of the temple, the Beit HaMikdash, a place where we can find God. All about coming face to face with meeting, bringing God into our lives. Right? So if that's true, what's the connection with this portion, which is all about civil law? Now, don't get me wrong. It's true that civil law is part of the recipe of Torah. And it's true that they're the moral lessons of the Jewish people. But we could just as easily have put those laws into the next book, or the book of Bamidbar, where we get into the nitty-gritty of Judaism. Why is this portion of civil law stuck here in between the incredible experience of Sinai and the journey of building a tabernacle or a temple? Right? So, obviously, we're being taught, okay, that the Torah is not meant to remain in heaven. The Torah has to come down to earth. And I want you to know this is a very difficult topic. People have a very hard time with this. You know, I know when we do, when Israelite does retreats, and God willing, we'll have our next one at the end of the summer, and those of you who haven't been to one, I urge you to come, plug, plug, plug. But when we do retreats, people basically come and go flying. It's an unbelievable experience. You know, or we have a summer trip in Israel. So come to Israel, and for those who have been to Israel especially, this is an incredible trip, because you come and you get to balance a little bit of touring with a little bit of learning. To sit in the old city of Yerushalayim and to study Torah is an unbelievable experience. You know, you go up on the rooftop, overlooking the Temple Mount and the Mount of Olives, and it's Friday afternoon, and the sun is coming close, you know, an hour or two to setting, and you break out a guitar, and you're singing, and then you go downstairs, you light candles. That's a lofty experience. And so you can't help but go flying, right? And everyone walks away from an experience like that inspired, not because we're so great, but because you can't not be inspired sitting on a rooftop in the old city of Jerusalem. But then you get back home, right? And you have to decide where you're going to buy your challah. How do you do that? How do you bring it down from the lofty to the mundane? And people have a very hard time with this. And they have a hard time with this, not only in terms of Jewish ritual. I see this, by the way, when kids come from America to Israel for a year. They come for a year to learn, right? In the Orthodox world, this has become almost a given. And I think that in other sectors of Judaism, thank God, people are starting to understand that this is a valuable experience, right? And so kids, straight out of high school, sometimes in college, they come to Israel, they study for a year, and they go flying. But when they get back home, little by little, they're worn down. And this is true in relationships, right? So, you know, you get married, you're excited. But then as the years drone on, it becomes very difficult to keep that romantic spark. How do you do that? So maybe the Torah is saying it's not supposed to be up in heaven, right? And it may well be that the reason that this portion is put into this spot is because last week's parsha was all about meeting God, and this week's portion is about where we meet God today. Because if the only way to meet God, right, if the only way to have an interactive and meaningful experience with Hashem is to be sitting on a rooftop in the old city, or to be up in Block and Hexter in upstate New York in at a retreat, then that means that for months at a time, you have no way to meet God. The real question is, how do you meet God every day? How do you find Hashem in the details that are all around you? And the message of this week's parsha is that you can meet God even in the courtroom. You can meet God in the boardroom. You can meet God in the bedroom. Right? Hashem is everywhere. And the details of halacha sort of open this up. You know, and I'll give you a couple of examples. The parsha opens, right, with a very challenging, to the Western mindset anyway, a very challenging idea, which is the idea of a Jewish slave. Ki tikne eved ivri, when you will purchase a Jewish slave. So most of us, you know, you read that verse, and that's very difficult. What do you mean, Jewish slaves? Like, nobody would buy a Jewish slave today. But of course, if you study closer the details of this halacha, it's an incredible system, right? First of all, a Jewish slave and the concept of slavery in Judaism has nothing to do with the slavery that we're accustomed to, which is, you know, sort of, you know, the Deep South in 1843, right? Of Nat Turner being beaten at the stake, right? Really what we're talking about here is an indentured servant, okay? And essentially what happens is, according to the Talmud, according to Rashi quotes this, is that a person has basically stolen money, right? And he can't return it, Right? Judaism, the consequence of theft is that you have to give it back. It's amazing. I once read a statistic that of black collar or blue collar crime as opposed to white collar crime, which is another discussion, right? Only 7% of stolen objects of convicts that are caught are ever returned. In other words, I'm not even talking about somebody who steals and they never catch him. I'm talking about they actually catch the crook, right? He stole something, and they put him on trial, and he goes to jail. But he never returns the money, because he's already spent it. And the American civil system doesn't deal with that. And people have become so used to the fact that there's no point in suing a person who has no insurance or who's going to jail, that nobody even bothers. So only 7% of stolen objects are ever returned. In Judaism, the first consequence is you have to give it back. Right? Now what happens if you can't give it back? What happens if you spent it and you're so poor that you have nothing that can be sold in order to pay back the person that you stole from? So the rabbi says such a person is basically indentured as a servant. The court actually values him. Say, well, let's see, you know, is he healthy? Can he work? How long can he work? What's his work worth? And they estimate on the market what his work is worth, and he is sold for that amount of time, right? If he can work to the equivalent of $100 a day, and he stole $1,000, then he's going to have to do 10 days of indentured servitude, right? And he's sold into slavery, into servitude for however long it is, up until the Shemitah year, right? Up until the sabbatical year, right? At which point he goes free. And when you really stop to think about it, it's an incredible system. There are a lot of, I'm not going to get too deep into this question, but there are a lot of things that come out of the system. First of all, what essentially happens is that a thief is forced to live with an upstanding family, right? A family that has work for him to do, that has a business or a field to work or whatever it might be. So imagine the impact on a person who's stolen to be living with a family. And second, imagine what a person must feel like, that he had to resort to stealing, that he has so nothing left in this world. He doesn't even have money to pay back his debtors in order to stay out of jail, or in this case, servitude, right? So such a person must think that he's worthless. Comes along the Torah and says, know that you have value, and we'll show you that you have value. And by working off his debt, he actually rediscovers his value, right? And by the way, the system of an indentured servant is an amazing system, right? The Gemara says, Kana Eved Kana Rav, a person who acquires such an indentured servant, has really acquired for himself a master. If there's only one pillow in the house, he gets it. If there's only enough food for one meal, he gets it, the indentured servant. Right? The master has to sleep on the floor if there's only one bed in the house, etc., 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 etc. So when you study the details of this halakha, it's no big deal to have an idea that we should value every human being. But when you begin to study the details and you find within the details of a mitzvah, of a law, right, the incredible ethical standard, then you come face to face with what having a relationship with God is all about. Right? At the end of the day, ethics are subjective unless they come from an objective source. Unless I have a connection with a higher power, with an objective source of right and wrong, right? Unless I have that relationship, then right and wrong comes from man. And if right and wrong comes from man, it will always be subjective. My right can be your wrong. So being able to see the detail of halacha teaches me to meet God face to face everywhere I look, right? And there are many such examples, right? And by the way, it's also interesting that the Torah's desire very clearly was that this thief should change who he is. That, by the way, is the second consequence. The second consequence of a mistake, of a chet, what some mistakenly call a sin, is that you have to change who you are. You have to do tshuva. Tshuva comes from the word lashuv, to return. You have to go back to being who you could have been before you stole. Right? You have to become the man you were meant to be. And the system of Eved Ivri, of the indentured servant, is a system that allows such a person to rehabilitate. Right? Which is very different from the modern Western society, where most, fortunately not all, have given up on ever rehabilitating hardened criminals. Right? Today's system, the penal system today, basically takes a hardened criminal, first of all, puts him into a penal system that makes him a worse criminal than he was. He learns more about crime in jail than he ever did on the street. And second of all, eventually it becomes about, let's just keep him locked up, which is not at all what Judaism has to offer. Right? In fact, we've spoken about this before. Judaism has no system of jail. The only time you ever find jail is when they don't know what to do with a person, which either is because he's waiting for a sentence, or as in the case of the Torah, when they really don't know what to do. Eldad and Medad are prophesying in the camp. Yeshua comes to Moshe. He's very upset. What do we do with him? And he says to Moshe, let's lock them up because we don't know what to do. Right? A woodchopper is caught chopping wood on Shabbat. They lock him up until they find out what to do with him. Right? And maybe I'll give you another example. There's an amazing Rashi on one of the mitzvot. If you have, by the way, a chumash, by the way, it's always worth, when you make this call, if you have a Bible, a Torah in front of you, easy to follow along. But in any event, whether you have one or not, if you look in this week's portion in chapter 21, verse 37, very interesting mitzvah. Ki yignov ish shorose, a man steals an ox or a sheep. Utvacho o mecharo, and he slaughters it or he sells it. Right? In other words, you stole my ox, right? My cow or my sheep, but you did something with it. You ate it. You had a barbecue. Now I catch you. You have to pay me back. Right? So what do? Chamisha bakar yishalem. So you have to pay me back five times the value, or five actual oxen for the ox. Tachat ashor. And it's for an ox that you stole, right? Or cow. You give me five back. Ve'arba tzon tachat aseh. And four sheep in place of the sheep or the lamb that you stole. Right? So Rashi notes the obvious question, and so does the Talmud, and so Rashi quotes the Gemara, he quotes the Talmud, right? And Talmud says, very interesting, right? Why would you pay four times for a sheep and five times for an ox? So the Talmud in Baba Kama is one of the three major tractates on business ethics and such laws, right? Baba actually means a gate. And originally this was one tractate, but it was huge. So the rabbis split it up into three. Baba Kama is the first gate, Baba Metzia is the middle gate, and Baba Batra is the last gate, right? So Rashi quotes this, right? And he says, it's again a Gemara from Baba Kama, right? Amar Rav Yochanan ben Zakkai. Rav Yochanan ben Zakkai, who by the way was the head of the Sanhedrin, says, Chas hamakom al kvodan shel briot. Hashem worries about the respect, the honor of all living things. So, if a guy steals an ox, and when you steal an ox, you basically walk it out of the place you're stealing it from. And the thief wasn't humiliated to have to carry it on his shoulders, right? Debate whether that means the work that he had to do, or the frustration of being caught. So he pays five times. But a sheep, that he has to carry on his shoulders, mishalem dalid. He only pays four times, ho'il v'nit bazebo, because he was humiliated through it, because it was difficult for him. In other words, the Torah even takes into account the feelings, the energy, the effort, the emotional state of the thief, which is unbelievable. And Rabbi Meir even goes further. Rabbi Meir, bo ure'e kama gdola kocha shel malcha. Look at the power, at the value of work. Shol shebatlo mimalachto hey. Se shelo batlo mimalachto dalet. An ox, when you steal an ox, you made somebody lose work. But when you steal a sheep, he didn't lose any work. So another opinion is that nothing to do with the feelings of the thief. It has to do with the person you stole from and the fact that he's also lost time at work. Right? The details within the halacha are the part that fascinate me the most. How far the halacha, the detail goes in understanding, you know, the human emotion, right? And all of the laws in this portion, when you start to look at them, right? If somebody digs a hole and leaves it uncovered, so he's responsible for the consequences, right? The Torah teaches you responsibility for your actions, right? And the fact that, and maybe the message of this portion is that we're capable of meeting God through the administration of Talmudic justice, right? And I'll give you a great example of this idea. There's an amazing story in the Talmud, and if you want to look it up, it's on the 33rd folio, on the second side, Lamed Gimel Lamed Bet, in the Gemara and Shabbat. There's an amazing story. Okay, the story says like this, right? Right? So there were three rabbis, Rabbi Yehuda, Rabbi Yossi, and Rabbi Shimon. In this case, it's Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai. V'yativ Yehuda ben Gerim. And Yehuda ben Gerim who was apparently a son of converts, that's why he's called Ben Gerim, a Ger is a convert, right, was also sitting there. So Patach Rabbi Yehuda V'amar, so Rabbi Yehuda says, Kama na'ima sehen shalumazu. Look how great are the actions of the Romans. Tiknu shvakim, tiknu gsharim, tiknu mechtzaot. They made marketplaces, right, beautiful streets like the Cardo in the Old City. If you haven't seen it, you can come visit us this summer. They made bridges so it was easier for people to cross the rivers. They made bathhouses so people could be clean. In other words, even though the Romans were oppressing the Jewish people, he said, look on the other hand, but they've done a lot of good. Right? Rabbi Yossi, that's kind of like looking at the military. It's amazing how many therapeutic technologies have come out of the military's quest for technological advance. So even though you might be sort of, you know, a more liberal individual who is anti-defense or military or whatever, you have to admit that they've done a lot of good nonetheless. So that's what he's basically saying. But he's saying it's like imagining, I mean, this is a very extreme statement in the Talmud. It's like saying that some good came out of Nazi experiments. Rabbi Yossi shatak. So Rabbi Yossi, I guess he was shocked, he didn't say anything. Na'ane Rashbi. So Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai says, okay, I can't keep quiet, this is ridiculous. Everything they made for themselves. Tiknu shvakin. You want to know why they made marketplaces? Lo shiv ben zonot, so they could have a place for their prostitutes. You want to know mrechtzaot, why they made the bathhouses? La den behen atzman, to make themselves beautiful. And why they made bridges? Litol mein meches, to take taxes. So halach Yehuda ben Gerim. Yehuda ben Gerim told this over to somebody and eventually went from word to word and it got back to the Romans. Nishmu l'malchut. So the Romans heard this. Amru Yehuda she'ila yitale. So Yehuda, who spoke well of the Romans, we're going to promote him. He became an exilarch in the area. Yossi she'shata yigalel tzipori. Yossi, he didn't say good about the Romans, but he didn't say bad. So we're going to exile him. Shimon, Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, shegina yareg. He put down the Roman Empire. He's going to be killed. Right? We can't tolerate somebody who speaks ill against the emperor. So him and his son, right? Tashu, they hid Bei Medrash. They went to hide in a Bei Medrash. Now that's an unbelievable thing, right? If you're a rabbi, Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, one of the great rabbis of the day, and the Romans have sentenced you to death, and you want to go hide, so where's the first place they're going to come looking for you? They're going to come looking for you in the Bei Medrash, in the house of study. So why do they go to the house of study to hide? Right? Okay, so they go to the house of study to hide. Kol yoma have maitelahu debitu rifta. And every day the daughter, their daughter would bring, or his wife, would bring bread, uvakuza demaya, and a jug of water. Right? Ukache, and they would eat. Right? Kitakif kzerata, which is also interesting. Like, they're in a Beis Medrash. Why doesn't she bring him real food? Bread and water, but okay. Kitakif kzerata, when it got worse, when the decree got worse, So he basically says, you know, we better get out of here. Right? Dilma Matsarila, right? They're afraid that they'll torture my daughter or the wife, and she'll have to reveal which base members they're hiding in. Right? To Magalilan. Azlu Tashu Bamarata. So they went and hid in a cave. Right? Itrachish Nisa, there's a miracle, and a carob tree grows, and a wellspring grows, right? And that's how they ate. And the Gemara goes on to say that they dug pits and they would sit in these pits because they were afraid their clothes would wear out. They would sit in these pits all day with sand up to their necks and learn Torah, right? And once a day they would come out to say blessings. They would put on their clothes and then they would throw them off and get back into the holes, right? And they sat in there for 12 years in this cave. And finally, Ata Eliyahu, Elijah the prophet comes. The Kama Pitcha de Marata, and he stays in the entrance of the cave. Ama man lo dai le Bar Yochai de mit kesa. So who's going to tell Bar Yochai that the Caesar is dead, and therefore batel gzerate, the decree of death on Bar Yochai is dead, is gone too. So they can go. So that's very interesting. First of all, why doesn't Eliyahu and Navi come? And if they're already going to have a miracle, Elijah the prophet is going to come, why doesn't he come into the caves to talk to them? So he doesn't come into the cave. He waits at the entrance to the cave. And why doesn't he talk to them? He talks about them. Very strange. It's as though he can't have a relationship with them. Right? So nafku, they go out. Chazu inchi, the kakachi uzari, and they see people plowing the fields. and sowing the fields, right? That's what you do. You're a farmer. Almost, so they said. Now remember these two guys. They've been studying 12 years in a cave. According to Jewish tradition, the Zohar, the Book of Splendor, the beginnings of Kabbalah was revealed to them. I mean, talk about being in a high, lofty place. They were as high as you could get, right? And they come out, right? And basically, they're in the portion of Mishpatim now. They're being told about what to do when your ox gores your neighbor. They see somebody plowing fields. People are plowing the field. Right? You come back from an Israelite experience in the summer in Israel, and you get home, and people want you to pay the bills. The bills, the bills, what are you talking about the bills? I found God. Right? So they can't handle it. So they see these people doing these things, and they call out, Manichin Chayolam, Va'oskin B'chayisha. You're leaving the eternal life, what life is really about, and you're dealing with the mundane of the moment. Kol makom shenotnim meneihem miyad nisraf. So every place they look burst into flames. So a heavenly voice came out, Yatzabat kol v'amalem lachivo lamiyatzatem. You came out to destroy my world. Chizru l'maratchem. Don't do me any favors, says God. Go back to your cave. So if a heavenly voice comes out and says that, you go back to the cave. Hadur azul. And they sit another 12 months. It's very interesting, by the way. They were in the cave for 12 years. Then they sat for another 12 months. What's 12 months? That's a year. Why doesn't it just say they sat another year? Somehow the number 12 is important here. Shata Amrei, right? So finally, after 12 months, a heavenly voice comes out again and says, go out of your caves. Nafku kol hecha dahavi machi. So now they're looking out. And there's still, one of them is still burning fire and the other one isn't, right? At which point they see, Ahu Saba, they see an old man. Tahavunakit tre madane asa. Okay? They see an old man who's holding two willow branches. The right, Ben Ashmasha, and he's running, right? The sun is setting and he's running. So Amulai said to him, Hani Lamalach, why are you holding the willow branches? Amulahu lekvod Shabbat. For the honor of Shabbat, right? Willow branches are sweet-smelling fragrance for besamim, for spices, right? V'tizgilach b'chad. They said, I have one willow branch. Why do you need two willow branches? Chad keneged zachor, v'chad keneged shamo. One is for the mitzvah of zachor, and the first 10 commandments, when we receive the 10 commandments, says, remember the Sabbath day. And traditionally, those are all the positive commandments, the mitzvot, making kiddush, and the challah, and singing, and all the positive things that the prayers on Shabbat. And when Moshe repeats the Ten Commandments 40 years later, he uses a different word, shamo, to guard, to safeguard, to cherish. And those are all the mitzvot that are negative, the things that we don't do. We don't light a fire, we don't write, etc. And at this point, Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai says to his son, see how beautiful the mitzvot, how beloved they are to Israel. And that was it, and the Jewish people, and that was it. So what is this whole story? So one way of understanding this story, right, is that the theme of this Agadah is exactly our question, right? Rabbi Yehuda was looking at the world of Rome and saying that in the world of Rome there's good. And Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai is saying there's nothing to be found in the world of Rome. In fact, the world itself is a waste of time. And the response, therefore, to the fact that the Romans are saying that they should die, which means that they don't merit this world, is to say we don't want this world. And so they go and hide in a base medrash, in a house of study, right? And when that doesn't prove to be enough, and that's why they're only having bread and water, because they don't want this world. And then finally they go and live in a cave, right? And in the cave, they have a pure existence. And when they come out of the cave, they can't handle the fact that there's still a world that people need to plow fields, until they meet this fellow with the willow branches. And they discover that you can take this world, you can take the single leaf, and you can transform it into a vehicle for bringing God into the world. You see, it's no big deal to meet God at Sinai, right? It's no big deal if on Yom Kippur you go to synagogue and the rabbi gives a magnificent sermon and you're inspired, or the cantor has such a beautiful liturgy and you're inspired. The big deal is, can you be inspired when you're sitting down at your breakfast table and blessing a piece of bread? Can you be inspired when you're about to get on the subway and someone looks harried and in a rush and you realize they're going to miss it and you hold open the door? And even though those seem like the most mundane things, in those little details, the world has changed. And the goal of Torah is to bring God into the world, is to transform the world. But you can't do that when all you have to hang on to is Sinai. Because Sinai occurred in order that we be given a recipe. And that recipe is a gift that's worth struggling every day. Right? And it's very interesting. I'll finish with one last detail. One of the ways that when you study an Agadata or a story in the Talmud, that you begin to ascertain sort of what the clues are to some of the details, are when you find a piece of it that's sort of a little different or off. And it's interesting that the number 12 is continuously repeated here, right? 12 years in the cave, 12 months, and there are other allusions to it. And that's because the number 12 is always incomplete. Always. In fact, 12 is the numeric value of the word get, right? Gimel being the third letter in the alphabet and tet being the ninth. A get is a divorce document, right? But you never find those two letters, the gimel and the tet, according to the Sfasem as the Ger Rebbe, you never find those two letters next to each other in the entire Torah. In fact, right in the Torah, there's a different word for a divorce document. In fact, in a get itself, in the divorce document, God forbid, there are 12 lines, according to Jewish tradition. Right? 12 is always incomplete. It will always become 13. We mentioned this recently. 12 tribes always becomes 13. Joseph's two sons are tribes of Israel. Right? A bat mitzvah girl on her 12th birthday is not yet bat mitzvah. She becomes bat mitzvah the day after her 12th birthday. 12 in a day, although it's debatable what that means. Right? So the use of the number 12 is telling you that if you think that you can escape the world, then your life is incomplete. You have to be willing to turn it into 13. You have to be willing to bring it back into the world. And that may well be the message of the portion of Mishpatim. That if we will be able to find, if we can find where we fit into in the sentence, it is only because we discover hidden in the details the love of Hashem and of the broader ideas.
This presentation by Rabbi Benny Friedman has been brought to you by Israelite, inspiring a renaissance in Jewish living. To access additional presentations from our online media library, order our best-selling books, or learn more about Israelite programming, including seminars, web-based learning, teleconferences, spiritual retreats, Shabbaton experiences, Israel missions, and leadership training, please visit us at www.israelite.org. That's www.israelight.org. You can also call us in New York at 212-947-4990 or in Jerusalem at country code 972-2-627-4890. We hope you enjoyed this presentation, and we look forward to learning with you at Israelite.